I'm Christopher Phillips, and I'm talking today about the history of official scoring. And more precisely, I want to frame it as a kind of baseball miracle, however, one that doesn't involve the Mets or the Padres. And the miracle involves instead these truths that we're supposed to know, that on one side there's numbers, there's objectivity, and on the other side there's old farts with radar guns. And the miracle I want to talk about is that all of us, nearly all the time, ignore that little voice in the back of our head that reminds us that the vast majority of hits are actually judgment calls, and they're judgment calls made by a fallible human being. And the miracle is that we ignore that little voice in the back of our head nearly all the time, and even people who are statistically inclined, perhaps especially people who are statistically inclined, ignore that voice as well. I'm not the first to point this out. In 1993, the wonderfully splenetic Bill Plaschke pointed out in an article for the Los Angeles Times that the people who determine players' earned runs, hits, and errors are unregulated, unsupervised, and in, he said, most cases, unqualified. His prompt was, how could such a thing happen? So that's what I want to talk about today. How could such a thing happen? And of course, the answer to this, at least to a historian, is to look back in time. Bill Plaschke wasn't the first person to notice this. In fact, as early as 1873, but undoubtedly before then, people are already complaining about the deplorable state of the scores in baseball. This is, as this crowd knows, even prior to the origins of the National League. And in this case, the New York Clipper was being complained about a hotline ball that went to the third baseman, and one of the scorers ruled it a hit and the other one an error. So given these kind of controversies and their incessance across the history of baseball, how do these individual subjective judgments end up as seemingly objective statistics? Well, the first thing for us to remember, at least, is that the presence of official scores is a choice. There is no need to keep track of hits and errors in order to play baseball. And in fact, it was a choice because baseball partisans and supporters have always wanted baseball to be a game in which you keep data. And so from the very origins of the National League, there has been a formal report that was submitted. This is a report from 2015, but the basic idea is the same. Those of you who are interested in this kind of thing will know there is no official play-by-play. For that, you have to go to RetroSheet. Instead, there are these aggregated statistics that simply get reported at the end of the game. This has been the same since 1877 for the National League, and in essence, the categories change. Originally, there was a category of bases made by runners in advance of the hitter on each hit that has since been rather sadly eliminated. So what I want to talk about for the rest of my time today is strategies that have been used for turning these subjective judgments into objective statistics. How does this happen historically? And the first one's fairly obvious to us. You figure out who scores. If you can control who scores, that's going to give you at least one approach. So the pioneering reporter and enthusiast Henry Chadwick said, the right person to score is a gentleman, because a gentleman will be able to render himself acceptable to all those who might make inquiries of him. And there's two parts to this. First of all, it's a man. And it's kind of remarkable that indeed this seemingly unnecessary restriction has essentially been followed for the remaining 150 years of baseball history, with only a few exceptions. But the other part, crucially, is that it's a gentleman. That is to say, it's somebody who doesn't need the money. That's important because in English scientific and philosophic tradition, scientists had to be gentlemen because they wouldn't be influenced by bribery or by base influence, by kind of base interests. And for scoring, he thought the same thing should be true. By the turn of the century, and even before in some cases, teams found gentlemen hard to come by. So they turned to the next best thing, which were newspaper reporters. And indeed, when teams started using newspaper reporters, the history of baseball reporters is essentially the same as reporters as scorekeepers, which is to say they were both formalized after the 1908 World Series, when reporters were stuck in the last row in Chicago and they had to climb a ladder in Detroit. They were unhappy about this. They organized. They formed their association. And very quickly, although their official purpose was creature comfort, what they really wanted to do was control who is in the press box and therefore control who gets to score. And that was their ultimate goal. And very quickly, they organized to change scoring rules where they were able to. So on one hand, reporters are cheap, they're available, they're knowledgeable in some cases, and they're there. So they're very good official scorers in that sense. But there's also problems with reporters, and I'll talk about two here. The first involves the Cincinnati Hit, this change made in the 1910s, promoted by the Cincinnati sports writer, who thought that a fielder's choice, where both the batter runner and the runner on the bases were safe, should be called a hit. He convinced the writers to agree. The writers changed the rules, and it was a hit for a year. Then they changed the rules back. Shockingly, this was called arbitrary. But it's also arbitrary in another sense, and that is, if you think about a press box, there's a series of people there all keeping score, and one of them has been arbitrarily deemed the official scorer. And this came to head in 1922 in a particularly visible way, when Ty Cobb was flirting with a batting average of 400. They went back through his records and discovered that on May 15th, months earlier, the official scorer, who is John Kieran of the New York Tribune, had given Cobb a hit and an error. But the American League's official statistician, Irwin Howe of the Howe News Bureau, had instead accepted the Associated Press score, which came from Fred Lieb, who was himself the head of the Baseball Writers Association of America. And the reason that Howe gave was that Lieb's score was better than Kieran's score. It was more accurate, it had fewer errors, and so he accepted the more accurate score. Lieb himself protested this because he quickly realized that this would take power away from the reporters and give it to the leagues. Perhaps not surprisingly, American League President Ben Johnson backed up his own statistician and said, "We're interested in accuracy. We're not interested in who happens to be deemed official here." Lieb, of course, disagreed with Johnson's claim that the baseball writers were too cozy with the hometown clubs and that Johnson himself repeatedly had to replace official scores with scores that he thought were more accurate. Nevertheless, Johnson didn't have any arrows in his quiver to do anything about it. He threatened to replace official scores with an additional umpire. This is a never-ending threat. It is always just a threat because the expense would be so great, but it never happens. And so this is, of course, an empty threat then and now. Nevertheless, this relationship became slightly more formalized in 1929 as the leagues appointed the BBWAA recommended scorers. And so it wouldn't be the agreement between local newspapers and clubs. Instead, the agreement was between the baseball writers and the league itself. And this system has essentially remained from them until the 1970s. In the 1970s, newspapers started prohibiting their reporters from acting as official scorers. There were a number of reasons for this. Perhaps the most important was that in an era of free agency, there were clear possible conflicts of interest to create the statistics and then report on salary negotiations and contracts that came as a result of the statistics. One little detail that's also important is that the names of official scorers were released for the first time the decade prior, and so there was no more hiding if you were the official scorer for a game. And this, of course, made newspapers rather nervous. So even though some writers continued to defend the practice of official scorers, and even the commissioner, Bowie Kuhn, noted that the system seems to work pretty reasonably well to me, nevertheless, by 1980, non-baseball reporters were appointed as official scorers. Some of these were retired reporters, but some of these also had actual day jobs. And this inaugurated the modern system of, quote, outside consultants being hired on annual renewable contracts, essentially at the desire of the league itself. So clearly this strategy did not really work. And by the 1980s, the Major League Baseball had essentially given up trying to find people with some special background. And instead, they turned to a strategy they had been using all along instead, which is that you can control how people score. This is another classic way to take individual judgments and turn them into reliable knowledge. Again, we can go back to this example from 1873, this Boston Reader complaining to the New York Clipper. Not surprisingly, Henry Chadwick had a response to this, and he said, oh, I have a solution to this. I'll just write down the rules for deciding what counts as a hit and what deciding what counts as an error. And so he said, in most cases, it's obvious. It's hit out of the reach of a fielder. That's a hit. But in cases where it's not hit out of the reach of the fielder, he said, let's use data. It was a remarkably modern statement. He said, let's look at what happens. And his example was, what happens when a ball is hit into that triangle between the pitcher, the catcher, and the first baseman? He said, well, I've seen it 30-something times, and only 4 of those times did that batter reach first base. Clearly, that's an exceptional hit, and so that particular play should be called a hit, in the sense that four of them were hits, which means that it is typical for it to be an out, which means that because it is typical for it to be an out, if it happens, then it should be a hit, if that makes sense, right? So what is normal and what is exceptional then get determined on the basis of previous statistics. This became the first of many attempts to actually write down rules for scoring to deal with the fact that the people couldn't be controlled themselves. So we have this from 1873. 1877, the National League used the term obvious versus non-obvious, and they did this by talking about if it's not obvious, don't give an error. That is to say, make sure it is obvious when you're assigning a hit or an error. In 1908, T.H. Murnane had his popular How to Play Baseball series, and he advocated rules of thumb. So he tried to divide it up. So for instance, short hop, that's a hit. Two hands on the ball, that's an error. And tried to go through these kind of classic cases in 1908. 1911, J.M. Cummings, an official scorer for Baltimore at this time, had a, quote, practical textbook on how to score. And he recommended scorers act with eternal vigilance in applying the rules and perform their duties impartially as though the players were inanimate objects he had never before seen. This is a kind of remarkable claim that the best thing to do is to act like you're a machine in this kind of scoring practice. In 1912, the very next year, I.E. Sanborn followed with his suggestion that to determine whether the play had been made by the exercise of ordinary skill. This is perhaps not surprising. After all, he was an experienced reporter. He's one of the founders of the BBWAA. And if there's one thing reporters know about, it's that which is ordinary. And indeed, this is the requirement that he suggested having. Attempts to manufacture objectivity just continued unabated, though. In 1925, H.G. Fisher provided his own guidelines, and what he did was divide everything up into cases, so a kind of classic casebook approach that you might see in a business school or something similar. The Sporting News in 1943 said, just use common sense, which even by 1943, this is pretty obvious that this is not a good strategy. 1971, Dick Young, and my favorite, said, just figure out who to blame. He said, if you figure out who to blame, you're going to know exactly what the deal is. And so these have all been written down. None of these have worked. One of the reasons why we know they haven't worked, or I should say, just for those of you who are unfamiliar, the actual rule book took Sanborn's advice. This shouldn't surprise us because it was newspaper reporters themselves, friends of Sanborn, who helped to rewrite the rules in 1949 to 1950, and they enshrined this ordinary effort, this idea that you know it when you see it because you know what's ordinary. You're a reporter. Nevertheless, this didn't really solve the problem. In 1887, the National League secretary in charge of scores said there's too much variation. When I interviewed her in 2015, Phyllis Marriage, the National League and American League person in charge of scores, said essentially there's too much variation. So clearly, whatever rules had been written down hadn't solved this problem of dealing with variation in scoring. So what's another strategy? Another strategy is to, instead of thinking about controlling who scores or managing how they scores, it's that to systematize the scoring process, or to put it differently, to make it bureaucratic. And so, indeed, the scores have long been part of systems. So the National League is particularly remarkable in this note, in the sense that Nicholas Young was in charge of scores both for the National Association and then the National League, followed by John Heidler. They both served both as secretary and president of the National League. And in 1919, Elias Sports Bureau became the official statistician for the National League. So in the National League, only 3 entities have ever been in charge of scoring since the origin of the National League. League. So in the National League, it's actually a pretty simple story. I'm not even going to go into the American League story because it's far more complicated, and the American League statistics, as anyone who's ever looked at this knows, are far less good than the National League statistics throughout the 20th century. But how do you make something bureaucratic? Well, the first step is that you make the numbers themselves official. And so this is what John Heidler did by keeping his own ledgers in his secretary's office, in the Heidler's secretary's office. This was kind of fawningly reported over in 1913 on an article in Baseball Magazine, Behind the Scenes in Organized Baseball, that Heidler's records are complete in every detail to mathematical perfection, that he would go through after each game and he would keep the home games in red and the away games in blue, and each line would be for a separate game. He'd keep a ledger for the players individually and, of course, another ledger for the teams, and then he'd be able to add it up and double check and come away with absolutely flawless records. Nevertheless, they took another step as well. That is to say, they made the scores themselves official. They made the scores part of the league. This happened largely in 1949 when Ford Frick, then National League president, soon to become commissioner, had long battled with the scores. He thought the scores were just, the quality of score was too inconsistent, even though at this point they had all been provided by the BBWAA. And what he did is he agreed to raise the fee. He agreed to pay more if the BBWAA would raise the standards. And so their agreement was that the pay would increase rather dramatically. We're talking $13 a game to $26 a game. But nevertheless, it would double, and in reply, the BBWAA would agree to only appoint scorers who had already covered 100 games in at least 5 previous seasons. Later, this was reduced to 3 previous seasons. And then as a result, in the rule book, it got written in for the first time that the scorer is an actual official of the game he is scoring. He's an accredited representative of the league, and he's entitled to the full respect and dignity of his office. And so this becomes a kind of official scoring in this sense. And a few years later, the rules clarified that the official scorers had sole authority to make decisions involving judgment. Sole authority, that is, until the 20th century, when they decided to actually institute an appeals system. So starting in 2001, you can make scoring itself official by creating an appeals process. So the first appeals occurred in the first years of the 21st century. By 2007, the process had been changed a little bit into a five-person committee, and then it was changed again in 2012 to our current system, which puts the executive vice president of baseball operations, then and now Joe Torre, in charge of all appeals, and gives teams a certain number of hours, about 72 hours, after decisions have been reported to appeal a scoring decision. So some key elements of this, it's straight authoritarian. Joe Torre can involve a committee. He only did so once in his first few years of appeals, involving a no-hitter game. Not surprisingly, he wanted cover. There's no need for him to provide explanations. There's no time limit for him to decide on appeals. And it's certainly not democratic in the sense that if every official score agrees with the decision one way, Joe Torre can still overrule them with what he thinks should be the correct judgment call. The number of appeals has surged under this new system from about 30 in 2003 to about 400 in the 2015 system. But nearly only about 15% of the appeals are successful, compared to close to half of the appeals for the umpires' rulings. Of course, the rules are different. We can think of reasons why that might be. What I want to emphasize, though, is that the appeal system didn't eliminate the need for credibility. It just put it entirely on the shoulders of the executive vice president for baseball operations, which is to say, now all judgments, all scores, are essentially acting as an appendix of the central commissioner's office here. And indeed, the scoring then would depend on not on the credibility of the individual scorers, who still are largely unknown, but rather on them acting on behalf or in place, in some sense, of Joe Torre's own judgment about these matters. So they're independent contractors. They still are hired and fired essentially at the whim of the league. But nevertheless, by portraying them as bureaucratic, as competent bureaucratic officials, you create a system in which scoring seems to emerge from the league office rather than, as it actually does, from distributed scores around the country. There's a couple other things that I won't go into too much detail that Phyllis Marriage actually has done over the last 5 years, over the last 8 to 9 years. She's no longer in charge just now. She retired a couple years ago. But nevertheless, one of the things she did was inaugurate the ability for official scorers to actually come together. And so I can talk more about this if you're interested in an official scorer seminar. There's an online bulletin board and a casebook. But I'll also point you to Sabre's own large crew of official scorers if you're interested in how some of these more recent innovations work to bring people together to actually standardize scoring in this way. So in my remaining time, I want to step back a little bit in the last minute or two and just simply say, where have we seen this in other settings? And of course, numbers that are created by fallible people, but which turn out to be reliable objective knowledge, is indeed arguably the story of the modern world in a certain sense. And we can see precisely this process. The first is by controlling who scores. It's kind of like requiring a degree in order to do certain sorts of practices. You assert that certain kinds of people are better at it than others, either because of who they are or how they've been trained. And the idea of gentlemen, as I've already discussed, is a very old idea that certain kinds of people are better at doing science. Certain kinds of people are better at coming up with factual knowledge than others. In terms of thinking about how they score, you might think of mechanical objectivity. This idea that subjectivity, say something like pain. This is an image from the 1880s from Wilhelm Wundt's laboratory. He wanted to know how to measure pain. He thought pain was just, oh my God, it's all judgment calls. So what did he do? He poked people and then had a mechanical design to actually record their response. So you create rules and mechanisms for turning subjectivity, for turning these kind of judgments into science. And this is indeed the same kind of thing you can think about when you require rules to be made, you require a certain kind of mechanization in the process. And the final idea is systemization. This is the idea of bureaucracy. And this is a very old idea. In fact, in the very years that Heidler was writing, the notion of bureaucratic authority was invented. Not surprisingly, by the German sociologist Max Weber in this very same period. Authority comes not from charisma. It doesn't come from knowing that score is really an amazing guy. It comes from him operating as part of an overall system. So I think we need to move away from simplistic divisions about what is judgment and what is numerical, and instead talk about the ways these are always intermingled. And here's a shameless plug, warning about it. So this story is in fact a part of a larger project I'm working on, looking both at both sides, at the scoring divide and the scouting divide. The book came out just in March. But to give you a hint, something like having StatCast make official scores decisions, which is something that's being discussed by Corey Swartz and others in Advanced Media, is not an obvious solution. For first of all, StatCast requires a huge team of people to maintain, a huge amount of human labor to actually make sure the data is good. But in another sense, it's not clear for something like a judgment call that an automated or kind of randomized system, that this happens 98% of the time, therefore it should be a hit or an error, will actually satisfy our need for making judgments. And perhaps that's the main message here, that it's remarkable how successful this ad hoc system of scoring has been, and it's remarkable that we treat these statistics as if they're independent of the people that we know have made them all along. Thanks very much. Time for a couple questions.
I got a question. Yep. Of the 400 appeals, who is standing to appeal, the players or the team?
Both. Okay. Both. The players, they change slightly, but the players typically is done by the player's representative or agent, okay. But teams themselves can also appeal.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah.
So I'm curious as to, we get just down to the question of hits versus errors.
Mm-hmm.
What was the impetus to actually even care about errors? Has certainly similarities, but they're not recording field errors even though those are critical to the score. So what was it about baseball that decided they need to focus?
It's a great question. The question is, why does baseball care about errors at all? And indeed, there have been movements over the years to get rid of errors. Chadwick himself got rid of errors from his own scores, his own scoring for a few years, because he thought errors would actually disincentivize fielders to go for hard balls. balls, because if they just stood there and watched it go by, it would be a hit. And if they actually tried to get it, they might get dinged with an error. So this has been controversial. The short answer, though, is that we wanted baseball to be more moral than cricket. The founders of baseball wanted it to be scientific, in the words of Chadwick, at least, scientific, manly, and moral. And indeed, part of the idea of baseball, from fair and foul to hit versus error to any number of other kind of early statistics, is that we wanted to label certain things as good. We wanted to give credit to certain kinds of behavior. We wanted to debit other kinds of behavior. And one of the easiest ways to do that is by actually keeping track of the data and by labeling it moralistically as good or bad. So this was a choice, and it's a choice that's made. Yeah.
Do you have a breakdown of how many of those 400 appeals are hits versus errors and everything else? It seems like that would be the main.
Yeah, I get the sense that the vast majority are hits versus errors, and the largest subset within that go to earned runs. But I did not get provided a list of the 400 appeals, and I don't even know if anyone has that list. I don't know if yeah.
I do.
You do, great. So that's your guy.
The 1949 rulebook sounds like kind of a landmark. What were other previous versions of the rulebook that also were landmarks? Defining what scoring was.
I'm not sure I can give an answer to that in a short amount of time. I mean, the 1949, certainly for official scoring, that's the first time that official scoring really is transformed. You'd have to ask experts on all the different rules for what their favorite example is for each other rule. But for official scoring, there's no previous set of rules that's as substantial as the 1949 to 50 switch. Yeah. One time.
Now with over-ear scoring games, is there any movement to redefine what a win is?
This actually came up in the official scoring committee discussion yesterday, so I will direct you to Stu Thornley there and others to ask these kinds of questions. There is obviously long been complaints about wins and losses, just like hits and errors, but again, the statistics are what we care about them being. All right, thanks very much.